Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, September 17th. This morning, we take a closer look at how this latest order from the Federal Department of Education is impacting our local private colleges as the University of Hawaii administrators try to get their arms around the impact of cuts to minority-serving institutions. We continue our look at the judiciary specialty courts. Today, it's Women's Court, as a program is launching on the island of Hawaii this month, and one here on Oahu just graduated its first cohort this summer. On our Manu Minute, we hear about a native honey creeper that's tangerine orange, the akepa. And got your power bill yet? We explain a new charge that Hawaiian Electric Company is including starting this month. You know, it's been a week since University of Hawaii President Wendy Hensel broke the news that a new directive by the U.S. Department of Education will severely cut millions from the university's budget as soon as October 1st. And that's just 2 weeks away. UH administrators are still trying to get their arms around the impact of losing what's known as Title III grants. It's federal money set aside for institutions that have large minority populations like UH, Chaminade University, and Hawaii Pacific University. We have asked to talk to UH administrators who are still knee-deep in assessing the damage, but we did get the opportunity to sit down with the provost at the two private colleges. Lance Askelson is at Chaminade. The Catholic University was already hurting from earlier cuts, and the school could see a hit of more than $9 million. At this point, it's not expected that anyone will lose their job, but Askelson says in the long term, the cuts could affect students' access to college.
Now, I want to emphasize that this funding goes to strengthen the entire institution. So the category of funding under which the Title III funds fall is titled Strengthening Institutions. And so the idea is, yes, there are some criteria by which institutions are awarded funds. In this case, we need to have a minimum of 10% Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander enrollment. But we also have to have a minimum of 33% Pell eligible, which is a measure of socioeconomic capability. So we're serving marginalized, historically marginalized students, as well as socioeconomically marginalized students. And those criteria help us strengthen services and academic quality for all students who attend Chaminade.
And the Pell eligibility, those are the Pell grants.
Correct. So the Pell eligibility is just a proxy for measuring how many low-income students are enrolled at the university. We're typically about 50%, and so the threshold is 33%. So it's important for your listeners to understand that it's not just the kind of racial or ethnic quotas. It's also about socioeconomic capability or access, as well as spending. The university spending per student is also one of the criteria. So if we're spending huge amounts of money per student, we aren't eligible for those grants. So it really is intended to strengthen institutions that are serving communities, rural, marginalized, low-income, historically marginalized communities, whether those be racial or other ethnic criteria. That helps the entire institution provide a better higher education.
So with the number that you stand to lose, what kind of, I don't know, warm bodies are we talking about? Yeah. Will it wipe out jobs for folks that administer these grants?
Good question. It's one of the implications we struggled with and wrestled with as we began planning for contingencies earlier in the year. And fortunately, we were able to make allowances through some attrition, not rehiring those positions, anticipating these monies might disappear. And so at this point in time, we are not anticipating that anyone would lose their jobs as a result of this. However, we are having to narrow some of our student services, student advising, career services. A lot of the direct services that have been funded by these Title III grants at Chaminade are services available to the entire campus community. And that's where we're going to have to be creative to ensure that we can continue to offer advanced career planning and paid internships and other types of mentorship from industry leaders in the community without the federal funding that's supported this for many years.
Are there any other foundations or places where you could somehow write up a grant proposal to supplement or offset some of that loss?
There certainly are, and I have to say that the community here in Hawaii has really stepped up. The Hawaii Community Foundation and so many of the individual philanthropic organizations have been incredibly generous, and we're very grateful. And I think they're supporting the entire K through 16 education endeavor right now, because all of us are struggling with loss of federal funds. But the truth of the matter is that no private or even state philanthropic entity can fill the void left by the loss of these federal funds.
What are you telling the students at this point? What programs are affected?
So we're telling the students that we are going to do everything within our power to avoid cutting programs, but some of the programs may become more narrow. And so, you know, hours may be limited. There may be fewer opportunities for paid internships or community mentoring. Some of the professional development that we provide to our faculty has been reduced. Opportunities to engage in undergraduate research have been curtailed. So I think it's less of a kind of direct loss of opportunity, but rather a narrowing of existing opportunities. That's what we're looking at in the near future.
And then do you provide, let's say, scholarships, direct scholarships then that may not get paid out?
Not direct scholarships to attend the university, but scholarships, for example, to travel to conferences to present research with faculty. So stipends to pay for summer internship opportunities, other sort of funded work directly to students to help them prepare for career opportunities. Take the MCAT or the LSAT and prepare to apply to graduate programs. Those are some of the programs that are going to be limited in scope as a result of this loss of funding.
Okay, so there's the immediate impact and the cuts this semester, but what about the long term?
That's where I think all of us are really concerned, because the broader narrative here is beyond those cuts to minority-serving institutions and the Title III grants. It's one of broad divestment from higher education, and specifically broad divestment from access to higher education from those most marginalized historically and currently. And so if you are coming from a multi-generational family, if you're coming from a first-generation college family, if you're coming from a low-income family, I think you should be very concerned about what this augurs for the future of college access. And the truth is that both here in Hawaii and across the nation, the high-paying jobs, the jobs that provide greater financial independence and determination, self-determination, require a college degree. And for good reason. It's global competition, and increasingly the competition is well-educated. And so if Americans and if Hawaii's population isn't able to compete globally and locally, then we're going to struggle. And so that college education is just going to be increasingly important while also harder to get with these cuts.
And what's the enrollment at Chaminade this semester?
The enrollment has held steady. So we're at about 2,200 students, which is where we have been historically over the last decade. And we're working hard to maintain steady enrollment. At the same time, we, alongside all of the colleges and universities in Hawaii, are facing enormous headwinds, and they're not limited to these federal cuts. There's a phenomenon known as the demographic cliff, which is a predicted decline, precipitous decline, in the number of college-bound high school graduates. And we're seeing that already here in Hawaii. We also are facing some of the lowest FAFSA completion rates in the country here in Hawaii. So FAFSA is the application for free financial aid from the federal government. And unfortunately, Hawaii high school students are completing those FAFSA at rates well below their peers. I believe last I checked, we were 47th in the nation for FAFSA completion, which means we're leaving money on the table that otherwise should be allocated to Hawaii students.
And then there was a hiccup last year, right, with the FAFSA?
It was a big hiccup. You're right, and it came out late, but they fixed those problems. And even this year's cycle, with the problems ameliorated, it has not improved our standing. And so other states have recovered their college going and their FAFSA rates. And what's important about FAFSA is it's not just to access federal aid. Almost all universities require you to complete the FAFSA to also receive merit aid from the university. 98% of our students receive some form of merit aid, but we're not able to allocate merit aid fairly unless they have completed that federal financial aid form. They're not applying, and I think there's a lot of discouragement about the value of a college education. And the truth of the matter is, a college degree has never been more valuable. The economic uncertainty right now is certainly concerning, but a college degree is going to put you in a better position to weather that economic uncertainty. It's also going to give you the ability to transform your career opportunities in ways that a high school diploma or something other than a college degree would not provide.
And Hawaii Pacific University has been dreading the news that was handed down this month. It estimates that its losses are more than $2 million in federal aid. Acting Provost Brenda Jensen says that the cuts are being characterized as race-based when the money goes to support the whole school.
So the latest order from the Department of Education affected the minority-serving institutions, of course, the Native Alaska and Native Hawaiian programs, specifically under the Title III funding. And so in that program, we had a strengthening institutions grant, and it was really a very broad wraparound services program that was targeted really for kids, as we were noticing kids coming out of high school right after COVID. We had a lot of needs for extra support for developmental math and writing. And so this grant was specifically tailored to offer additional tutoring, additional help, specialized instruction for that, specifically the math and reading. Even though it was a Title III grant, it was open to everyone. It was open to anybody. We were targeting Pell-eligible students as well as just anyone who needed the extra help for developmental math and reading. And so in that regard, it was really supporting instructors and advisors or specialized coaches, and a lot of actual support for students in their role as peer mentors. So it was a lot of leadership development as well. So that was a fairly large grant that was supporting about $600,000 to $700,000 a year, and the overall award was about $3.5 million.
Under the Title III funding, were there any direct, let's see, scholarship supports that were included as part of that program?
This one did not have direct scholarship support. It was more about the support once they were actually in the program. We do have other grants that are in that category, but this particular one did not have scholarship support.
And because this is coming up so fast, you're having to deal with this. I don't know if you got additional guidance over the weekend from the Department of Education, whether you could still use the money in this way or if it's just a definite dry up of those funds.
Well, what the instruction that came out with the cancellation seemed pretty clear. And if my interpretation is correct, I think that what it is saying is that we basically have the fiscal year starts on October 1st, and so there are basically 2 weeks left in the current fiscal year. And so we have a year of no-cost extension is what we call it. Basically, you have another year to wrap up spending the remaining 2 weeks of your grant. And so we have a little bit, just because the entire grant did start late and we did have what we call rollover funds from year to year, we have a little bit more than 2 weeks worth of funding to be able to close out the project more gently. But that's basically what it means. That's our interpretation. If we had been spending according to the actual schedule of the grant, then we would only have 2 weeks notice to continue to support everybody. But because we were a little bit delayed in the overall start of the grant, and we were counting on this ability to extend into the next year of the grant, which is a very normal and typical thing to do, we do have a little bit more time to figure out how to close up the activities, if that makes sense.
Will there be any positions cut, as far as you can see?
Yes. So this grant does have support for about 9 full-timers. And so we are going to have to figure out how to discontinue those that are specifically grant funded and see if we can work that into the regular operational budget. And so that activity is a little bit too new for us to be able to say yes or no, we're going to be able to lay people off. We haven't been able to make that decision yet, but overall, this is one hit that's a part of other financial concerns that are happening across the board. And so we do have to figure out with a little bit more time. I'm very grateful that we have the time to work this out, and it is certainly our priority to save as many jobs and keep as many of our people in the family as we can. So we are thankful that we have the time to be able to work on that project. The Department of Education is the agency that allows the characterization of us as a minority-serving institution. But then once you reach that designation, it actually is a eligibility point that can be used amongst other federal agencies. And so once you're minority-serving, then you might qualify for particular programs across federal agencies that, even though it's technically something that is monitored and overseen by the Department of Ed, it qualifies you for funding in other agencies as well.
Gotcha. But is that door going to get shut? Is that the fear?
Yes. The main point that's coming out in so many of these press releases is just this thought that the grants projects themselves are somehow race-based. That's so incredibly not true. In all of these cases, just because this was the way that the funding was structured doesn't mean that there was anything going on that was offering preferential treatment.
That was Brenda Jensen, acting provost at the Hawaii Pacific University, who we talked to yesterday about the latest cuts to its federal funding. We also heard from Chaminade Provost Lance Askelson about how the private university is dealing with cuts of more than $9 million. Nationally, the cuts total some $350 million. And full disclosure, both Chaminade and HPU are HPR underwriters.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
Hawaii Public Radio is looking for an experienced, community-minded business development professional to join the team, and today is the last day to apply. This full-time position is ideal for an individual who thrives on building partnerships and successful sponsorship strategies. Pay range and more at HawaiiPublicRadio.org/jobs.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering a Master of Accounting program. Learn more at Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
You know, all this week, we've been learning about the judiciary specialty courts, from the first drug court program that's been in place for about three decades to a court for girls and now a court for women. In June, the judiciary honored the first six graduates of the Mohala Wahine program, also known as Women's Court. HPR's Emma Kyries attended the ceremony and captured an emotional speech from graduate Ashley Onkog.
I was in a place where I thought others didn't understand what I was going through and definitely couldn't help me. I had so much severely deep trauma, the only escape I knew was drugs and the criminal lifestyle. Being in that lifestyle was a temporary escape for actual things I was going through and ended up with many detrimental consequences. Why the change? Because I was tired of the same old outcomes, being hurt, feeling alone, chasing of money, drugs, and the lifestyle, and hurting the ones I care about most. Also, jails and institutions, nobody likes that. While being in jail this last time was the hardest, but it's exactly where God needed me to be. truly alone, on my knees, nowhere to go, no one to turn to but him. It allowed me the space and time to build a relationship with him, read his word, and open my heart and my eyes to the many blessings around me. I have been so blessed with being able to rebuild a strong relationship with my mom and my son, Blazin. Being able to work on rebuilding a relationship with my son, Donovan. Building and growing a beautiful relationship with my fiance, Kekala. All while having so much support, love, and encouragement from them alongside all my sisters in this program. And with also the heart and effort of the POs, the judge. You guys didn't give up on me even when I was a lot. My case manager, and just everyone else in my life, I'm so grateful. Where am I going is I am taking one step at a time, now knowing that I'm not alone. I have the Lord guiding me on the daily, alongside with the many blessings that, which is all you in my life. I also know through true relationships with others that I am loved and supported. I will continue to work on being the best version of myself.
You know, Women's Court began in 2023 as a pilot program in the First Circuit on Oahu. This past legislative session, lawmakers made the program permanent and are hoping to copy its success on the island of Hawaii. A Women's Court launched there this month. We had a chance to talk to First Circuit District Court Judges Mark Browning and Trish Morikawa about why it's important to offer these programs. Browning starts us off.
I served in family court both as a district family court judge and then later as the senior judge of family court. One of the fundamental things that we saw in family court, and they still see, it's sort of the epicenter where you see the most pressing issues that we face as a community, whether it be violence or domestic violence, drugs, mental health, all those different things. And I was really fortunate in the 90s when I started that I was able to have mentors who taught me that one of the things that a judge has to do and should be doing is keeping track of how the system is working to adjudicate those issues, but more importantly, to try to find out and notice where the system is not working. And we saw that fundamentally in a different ways. And a perfect example of that is girls' court. When we started to look in the early 90s at the data that showed that the incarceration of girls was way above the national average as opposed to in Hawaii, as opposed to what incarceration rates for males was at the time, which was far below the national average. And so, one of the individuals who was very fundamental to helping us understand these principles was Judge Wong, Frances Wong. And she taught us, and it's a lesson that I took to heart, that judges can act as a catalyst to make changes and to systems to make a difference. You know, when we started with our specialty courts in family court, with juvenile drug court, as well as girls court, we sort of started on this path, and I was appointed as the presiding judge of the juvenile drug court and had the privilege of serving as the presiding judge for 8 years, and as a result of that, learned how effective specialty courts could be. With respect to how women's court started, I had that idea in my head. I became chief judge of circuit court in, I think, about 2017, and there were a lot of things that I wanted to do, and things that I wanted us to improve on. And I got a good start at that, and then COVID hit and brought everything to a standstill. So towards the end of COVID, I started looking at, after we got the court sort of operating again, at least given the circumstances that we were facing that time, I started doing some research about women who were incarcerated in our prisons, having learned those lessons in family court. When I started looking at the data was pretty startling, and it was very consistent with what we saw with respect to the genesis of girls' court. And the data basically showed that, and I can't remember specifically all the data, but I do remember that the data showed that the rate of incarceration for women in the last 20 years at that particular point had increased about 1,000% compared to men, which was just 20%. Then we started looking a little bit closer. We looked and found that the pathways for women into the situation, getting themselves into to prison, were different than for males. And that meant that there were more issues of domestic violence, more issues of substance abuse, more issues of family dysfunction, more issues of prior sex abuse. And so once I got that information and had a moment to start working on this, I started the process of talking to the Chief Justice. And Chief Justice Rechtenwald had always been very supportive of all the initiatives that I'd started. And so I asked him if this would be something that he would want us to pursue, and he was very, very supportive. At the same time, one of the reasons why I began to think this was the right time is that I'd learned about, from the Chief Justice in that conversation, about Governor Ringel's Women's Prison Project. And also, you know, when you're starting to put a specialty court together, and I had experience putting specialty courts together again back when I was senior judge of family court, is that I needed to know that I had the right people around that would make it successful. And so I immediately thought of Judge Morikawa as being the right person to be successful in the development of women's court. So it started from that, and we were very fortunate that we had support in the legislature from the Women's Caucus. And the idea was, as we had proven through other specialty court initiatives, is to start it up on a temporary basis, get temporary funding, and then put together data so that we could go back to the legislature and make it permanent. And I think that's what we did.
Judge Morikawa, I mean, you folks were able to celebrate the first graduates. So talk about what that was like, knowing that you'd come this far.
We always knew it was going to happen. You know, we go in saying it's going to happen, but we were still very excited that it actually did, you know, because it was our first class. And with it being new, you just don't know. So we were super excited. The women all wanted to be part of that first class. And some of the women, when they came in, they said from the beginning, we want to be the first graduating class. We want to show that we can do this and that this program is helping us. And it worked. And so we were just so grateful that we had all the support that we had and that the women were so on board.
And talk about the programs that they had to complete.
Everyone had to go through substance abuse treatment. So that varied depending on the individuals. I think most had been in some form of residential treatment and then outpatient treatment. So they all had to do substance abuse treatment. So that's an outside provider that helped us with that. And then a number of them also have different forms of mental health treatment, be it psychiatrists, a psychologist, therapist. So a number of them were doing therapy in some way, shape, or form. And again, that's through the outside providers that are assisting us. They all had to obtain stable housing. They all had to either work or go to school or have a disability that didn't allow them to work or go to school. So they all had to do that. They all had to complete our women's court requirements that were set up by the legislature. So the legislature required the program to provide information to the women in regard to work, education, health. There is a variety of requirements, and our staff put together a program. It's a 12-month program. It has 12 units, so one unit a month, and they have to complete that unit and take a test to say that they passed it. And so they had to complete all 12 of those units, along with having to stay clean and sober for, you know, each phase of the program requires different things. But generally, everything that I just said is the requirements that they have to do, along with meeting their probation officers, meeting their case managers, coming in and doing drug testing.
Yes, one step at a time, right?
Right.
Just holding their hand, getting through to the next level. And then what about, you know, now, like once they're graduated?
Once they're graduated, technically with probation, once somebody is off of probation, we are technically, I guess the way the rules are, we're not supposed to contact them. But we did for our women, and we asked if they would be willing to sign basically a waiver that would allow us to contact them after. So they all did. And so our thoughts are that, well, our plan is to reach out to them 3, 6, 9, and 12 months after to check on them. And then yearly after that to also check criminal histories on everybody. So our first 3 months comes up, I think, in like 2 weeks. So we actually are just in the process of making sure that we're all in agreement on the questionnaire that we're going to give out to them. And then we're going to start following up and seeing how they're doing. So we have been in contact with a bunch of them. Sometimes they'll call, sometimes they come around. We have been reaching out to a few because people, organizations, or things have been wanting to find out more about women's court. So they've been gracious enough to come and talk. So, yeah, we're following up. As far as we know, they're doing well.
Judge Browning, do you want to jump in here? You know, I mean, the fact that this has gotten off the ground here on Oahu, you have your first cohort, and now you're looking to help there on the Big Island.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's happened in history, especially courts, is, you know, the judiciary is divided up in circuits. So we're the first circuit. You know how that is in terms of different circuits, but every circuit is in and of itself semi-autonomous. So when we have started the specialty courts, we have been able to show with the various different successes we've had that it is something that will work and does work. And therefore, one of the things we try to do is we try to speak to our brethren on the neighbor islands, and they're very interested in some of these projects. If they are at a particular point where they have the resources to start it, they will often come over and train or just observe and decide whether it meets the needs of their community, and the Big Island apparently has. And I think that, you know, one of the things about the different specialty courts on the neighbor islands is it's got to be built specifically for the circumstances that exist within that particular community. And so the Big Island Women's Court will probably be a little bit different from what Oahu looks like. But in essence, the values and the sort of structure that has been built around women's court will be the same.
You can tweak it, but you want to customize it, because if there's a greater need in one area, you can rise up to that occasion.
And they have different resources, too. That's the other thing that you have to consider when you start one of these courts on the Big Island or Maui or Kauai, whatever. You have to take into account what the infrastructure within the community is, because it's that infrastructure that builds the team around drug court that makes it successful.
Well, I think, you know, just the whole idea, if you can break a cycle, right, if you can help with the parenting skills, and then you help with the next generation, because it's not just for these women, but for their children.
Yeah, and it's also, that's a really important point, because one of the things that I failed to mention was part of the data showed that, you know, as a result of the way that we were incarcerating women, and particularly women who were nonviolent, is one of the results was is that it was adversely affecting children. Because you're taking a parent away, irrespective of what that condition of that family is, that's very traumatic for those children. And they end up becoming victims, in a sense, because they end up, in many instances, in the CPS system. One of sort of the analysis that we did before we got to the place where we started our women's court here was, what was the cost to the community if we didn't make the change? And I understand we're not giving up accountability. Accountability is very important. We understand that. But what are the outcomes that we're looking for? Under the prior to women's court, the only outcome was prison in many instances. And the outcome of one of the consequences of that, again, as you said, was a negative impact on children. But secondly, the services within the various different prisons are minimal at best. And so many of these individuals would recycle and go back into prison. The cost to the taxpayers is exponentially higher to continue on that path as opposed to something like women's court, which is very structured and there is accountability. But the success in terms of giving back to the community somebody who has been able to get healthy and get the support system that will make them successful and contributing members to our community is so far, in terms of cost, is so much better for our community than the outcome the other way.
We've been hearing from Circuit Court Judges Mark Browning and Trish Morikawa. They were talking about the success of Women's Court on Oahu. Tomorrow, we plan to take a closer look at the Women's Prison Project.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Renewable Energy Services, based in Honoka'a on the Big Island, serving the community's solar energy needs since 1992.
Today on The Daily, new information about the suspect in Charlie Kirk's assassination and the White House plan to use Kirk's death as a rationale to crack down on left-wing groups. I'm Michael Barbaro. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30 following Marketplace.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, presenting vocalist and composer Paula Funga, performing a tribute to Aretha Franklin in two sets this Friday. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. In today's Manu Minute, University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the native Akepa, and a little bird told us that this honey creeper is one of Patrick Hart's favorites.
Hawaii Akepa are an endangered Hawaiian honey creeper that are found only on the Big Island. As honey creepers, they're descended from an original group of finches that found their way to Hawaii from Asia over 5 million years ago. They're a very unusual bird in that the males are bright, almost fluorescent orange, like the color of a traffic pylon, while the females are grayish-green, with a wash of orange across their breast. Akepa are among the smallest of all honey creepers, weighing only about 10 grams, or a third of an ounce. In Hawaiian, Akepa means nimble and quick, which they use to their advantage as they forage high up in the canopy of ohia trees and use their crossed bill to pry open leaf buds in search of insects and spiders. Akepa were once common all over the Big Island, but today they're only found in old-growth ohia and koa forests above about 5,000 feet in elevation. Below that, they can get bitten by mosquitoes that transmit avian malaria, and a single bite of a mosquito can mean death for one of these birds. Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, on the windward side of Hawaii Island, is one of the best places to hear the pleasant, high-pitched trill of the males as they try to impress the wary females during breeding season. Akepa are also unusual in that they're obligate cavity nesters. Whereas most other honeycreepers build cup nests in the outer branches of trees, Akepa require natural cavities that only form in the trunks and limbs of the biggest and oldest ohia and koa trees. Because of this, the size of the Akepa population, estimated to be only about 10,000 birds, is also limited by the amount of high-elevation, old-growth forest that still exists on Hawaii. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Biology Department.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters' 15th anniversary celebration, online September 18th to 21st, featuring Kona Noir, Kau Yellow Bourbon, and more. BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com/anniversary.
A hunger strike by 30,000 prisoners in California.
Nowhere in the history of the United States had this ever taken place.
I didn't submit. I didn't conform. You didn't break me. So I could walk with my head high out here.
The protest that ended indefinite solitary confinement. Well, the next reveal.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Hawaiian Electric customers will see a new fee on their bill this month. HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote is with us to tell us what that's all about. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
So this fee, they want to know how much is this going to cost them and what's it for?
Yes. So first things first, it is a small fee. It will vary on where you live and how much energy you use. But for the typical HECO customer, we're talking in the realm of like 6 to 18 cents a month. And customers are going to have that surcharge on their bills for up to 2 years, and the revenue it generates is going to go into a new trust fund that's going to be managed by the state.
Okay, and then what's this trust fund for our listeners who may not be tracking this?
Right. So this is brand new. The state is going to use this trust fund to pay out developers of renewable energy projects who have agreements with HECO in the event that the utility defaults on its payments and cannot pay developers who provide power to the grid. And this is a result of HECO's current credit rating. So as listeners may know, HECO's credit took a big hit after the Maui wildfires in 2023. And developers since then have said it's now a lot riskier to work with HECO and a lot harder to get financing for new renewable energy projects. And so this trust fund is kind of a stopgap measure to try to address those concerns. It was passed by lawmakers this year, and it was broadly supported by renewable energy developers, including AES Hawaii, which is the largest renewable power supplier to Hawaii. And I spoke with Eliza Talbot, who handles government affairs for AES Hawaii.
So the reason this is important is because we have to have our development projects financed, and financiers really prefer to have assurances in place to de-risk projects and make sure that they are possible to carry through. And so with HECO's credit rating being dented a bit, it meant that potentially borrowing for financing costs would be higher. This bill will essentially relieve that stress from financing parties so that we can ensure that we are getting paid and that their investment is sound in Hawaii's renewable energy projects.
The exact financing agreements are in progress and those details aren't clear to us, but HECO has said that some developers it's in talks with have said that financing costs would be 20 to 30% higher without the creation of this trust fund. And those costs would likely be passed on to customers. So uncertainty around HECO's financial status has really affected negotiations with developers since the fires. We even saw one developer, Clearway Energy, who pulled three of its proposed projects at the end of last year over concerns about HECO's financial distress and its change in credit since 2023.
And so this money's being put aside in case Hawaiian Electric is unable to pay. But what happens to that money if, you know, it never needs it, if the event never occurs?
Right. That's a great question, because the state will hold on to that money for as long as HECO's credit rating is below investment grade. And their rating has improved since its low point since the fires, but it's not yet crossed that threshold. If and when it does, the trust fund will be dissolved and all that money will be returned to HECO customers. And the law is also capping the amount of money that can go into the trust fund at 15% of the total monthly payment to the group of developers who are currently in negotiations with HECO about a new slate of renewable energy projects. So once that amount is reached, the surcharge will also be removed from customers' bills. And HECO is projected it could take over 2 years to bring that fund up to that level.
And how many projects are we talking about?
So HECO said that the law currently applies to 7 projects in negotiations, but it could cover more in the future. And these are mainly solar and storage projects across HECO's territories. And collectively, they would bring huge amounts of renewable power onto the grid. So for instance, AES has a solar and storage project in the works on Hawaii Island that Talbot says would support 20% of that island's total energy demand. And these projects would provide low-cost power to Hawaii's residents. And they would also help the state meet its energy goals. But they've been facing just huge headwinds since they've been in negotiations and in development. And I was actually in another recent meeting with HECO, the Public Utilities Commission, and the developers. Rebecca Dehuff Matsushima leads procurement for HECO. And she told the Public Utilities Commission in that meeting that never before had they had so many things change in the process of trying to negotiate power purchase agreements with developers. So negotiations for these projects started during the tail end of the pandemic, which resulted in, of course, huge supply chain issues for the renewable energy industry. Then, of course, HECO's financial status was dramatically affected by the Maui fires in 2023. And now, federal policy changes are once again scrambling the landscape for renewable energy. So solar and wind projects in particular need to break ground much sooner than expected in order to qualify for tax credits. And there are new restrictions on where developers can source materials from. And in that meeting, Rebecca Dehuff Matsushima kind of summed up the whole picture like this.
No matter how well we plan, any local, national, global event has the potential to really largely impact these projects. We've seen it over and over again. And every time we think we've made it past the, you know, we're going to be smooth sailing, some new huge event happens that really throws a wrench in the projects. And so we know those future events are unpredictable, but we do know that what is predictable is that they're going to have an impact on the projects if and when they occur.
And there's great pressure to get these projects going, right, before the end of the year.
Yeah, exactly. So the safe harbor period is until July 2026, right? And things just don't move that quickly when you're talking about these bid-scale energy projects typically. So this new trust fund is actually part of a suite of things that Hawaiian Electric and developers are pushing for to manage these changes and also make the state renewable energy development process more resilient and faster in light of all these external shifts. So HECO has also asked the Public Utilities Commission to expedite its approval of new projects, and they're calling for the state to convene a task force to review like the notoriously slow state and county permitting process.
This was done when the AES coal plant was shutting down. We had the Powering Past Coal Task Force. We found that to be an extremely effective task force. And to get that in place ASAP, even before the projects are approved, I think having something now, because the permitting timelines can take so long. So really getting that set up and moving forward, I think would be helpful, and applying it to all of the counties.
Yeah, I mean, the permit issue, that's just a big concern for folks because you don't want these projects to, you know, be dead on arrival.
Exactly. And I do want to note that the legislature has taken up this issue, and they passed a separate measure this year to create a task force to investigate permitting delays. But it's not specifically focused on energy, right? Because permitting impacts any sort of development in Hawaii, building, county projects, state projects, infrastructure. So they have a long to-do list. And what the energy community is looking at is really something that addresses our needs to get more renewable energy on the grid. So that's a separate initiative. It's being led by State Representative Gregor Ilagin, and we'll see results from that, but we'll also see what the PUC, what the Public Utilities Commission, and what the developers and HECO and other stakeholders come up with to really hone in on our energy demands.
Yeah, I know lots of these solar companies are worried about, you know, what may happen in the short term and long term between the tariffs and these deadlines that may seem impossible to comply with. Everybody's keeping their fingers crossed.
Certainly. And this is, in fact, impacting every level of energy development. So folks may have also seen that rooftop solar credits are going away at the end of this year. So if you're looking to install rooftop solar, the window in which to get credits for that is just another couple of months, as well as credits for electric vehicles. Folks only have until the end of this month of September to get rebates for purchases of new and used electric cars. So the landscape's really changing.
Yeah. Well, I just had a solar company walk through my neighborhood asking if I had solar, and I do. But yeah, they're trying to drum up business and try and get people, you know, switched over to systems if they can, while they can.
Right. And part of the reason why at the utility scale level, so these big energy solar farms that provide massive amounts of energy to the grid, as well as the developers who work on the individual residential rooftop solar and storage, are trying to take a proactive approach to this is because now with the new deadlines, everyone is in competition for the same resources. So there are all these projects that are trying to come down the pipeline. Hawaiian Electric came out with news that it's seen a spike in the amount of applications for new residential solar. All of the developers who are looking for resources or have the same suppliers are asking for the same things. Just to avoid the bottlenecks, they're asking for the Public Utilities Commission, lawmakers, other people who are involved in the energy infrastructure to make sure that this can be as streamlined a process as possible.
Yeah, these are challenging times. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that is it for us today. On the lineup tomorrow, we will hear from two governors. We plan to talk to Governor Josh Green about the loss of a major golf tournament on Maui due to water restrictions and drought conditions. And we'll catch up with Governor Linda Lingle, who has spent a good part of her time since leaving office to help women behind bars as part of the Women's Prison Project. What are your thoughts about the drought on Maui? How are you affected? Worried about the loss of millions of dollars to the economy because the PGA Tour is pulling out at Kapalua? Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.